Welcome to the Impact Equals podcast from British International Investment, where we explore the impact investment industry, what it is, why it matters, and how it's reshaping how business is undertaken in many parts of the world. In this episode, we're unpacking what happened at COP30, including discussing what was delivered and where the gaps remain in mobilizing capital for climate and development. To answer these questions, we brought together three leading voices on climate action for an event at our offices in London. They're Nick Mabey, Chief Executive of E3G, Rianne-Marie Thomas, Chief Executive of the Green Finance Institute, and Amalia Min, Managing Director and Head of Climate Diversity and Advisory at British International Investment. And it's Amalia who is chairing the discussion.
I'm going to come to you first, Nick. I know, and you know, we've worked together for many years, so I really do know how much yourself and E3G are focused on both the policy and the politics of climate and the transition we need to see. So can you tell us a bit about what you think came out of COP30, recognising actually quite a lot was prior to COP30. A lot of commitments were made before even the events opened in Brazil. So I would love to hear more from your insights.
Right. Well, thanks so much. And thanks for inviting me. There's a lot of post-mortems of COP30 going on that I think it's very simple in a way. It didn't do what we need, but it perhaps did a lot more than people think. And it's important just not to look at COP30. Actually, this was a critical year. It was one of the 10th year from Paris, the second ambition cycle where countries had to put forward new targets. And I suppose the first thing to remind ourselves is it worked. The Americans withdrew, but the system held. People turned up, they delivered targets, they agreed, even if it was a moderately weak agreement. But multilateralism held at the beginning of the year. This is not Trump won. People weren't sure about that. Unfortunately, it didn't deliver what we need on ambition. And that was the major thing we were looking at was since Paris and with the targets people put forward this year, we're down to around 2.6 degrees projected for 2100, which is a 1 degree different from Paris. So that's a big progress, but it's 1 degree more than a 1.5 safe level. So it's still in the unsafe level. If we delivered everybody's net zero targets they've put forward, we'd be around 1.8, so much, much safer. So the first thing is you have to be planning for around a 2.5 degree temperature rise in everything you build and everything you do, because that's where the current state of the world is. We think people will do better than that. We think China massively under-committed to what it could do. We haven't seen India's commitment yet, but we see that being there. There was an agreement on a kind of relatively soft mechanism for trying to address that gap, work with countries them to do more. We didn't get agreement on a transition away from fossil fuels roadmap, which was kind of the joker in the pack that came in at the end of the negotiations, slightly shook things up, despite there being over 80 countries in favor, and as far as our intelligence shows, very few major countries against. But the thing was, fossil fuel producers were very empowered by the geopolitics. And this was the major COP I've seen with the least leadership attention, not because in a sense they don't care about climate change. There are a lot of things to care about this year, from the geopolitics to hard security to economics. And I think we suffered from the distraction of geopolitics rather than necessarily the huge pushback of geopolitics. But again, when you're trying to build a huge economic revolution, which requires a total reform of every institution, domestic and international, not moving forward is kind of failure. So that, you know, that's our problem. We need to get back on the priority list. But I also think if we look at this, a lot more was agreed than you think. So China, yes, it lowballed. I've never seen China go out and spin. It was going to do 10 to 12% and end up with 7 to 10%. That's kind of the weirdest piece of diplomacy ever, lowballing your lowball. But between China and Europe's 90% by 2040 and the UK's 80-ish percent by 2035, we've got some of the world's largest energy importing set agreeing major cuts. And just that China commitment is going to, according to the IEA, if you add the commitments up, peak coal and peak oil before 2030, and gas, they assume a huge glut. which is interesting because while it will essentially make things like heat pumps less attractive, it will also make new exploration hugely unattractive, new LNG terminals. So it shifts. The major thing coming out of this cycle is a massive shift in the economics of fossil fuel exploration and moving into that peaking and working down and transitioning. And I think that is a totally different world. Once you're in a decline scenario, financial markets work differently, investment cases work differently. You have to model risk much more carefully. And I think we've been fooling ourselves that we've been doing that. So I think that's one of the big things that came out this time. Europe going to 90%, UK to 81%. That is incredible. If you asked me when I started my journey at the late 80s, if we'd ever, that's zero. I mean, yeah, by any extent and purposes. That's whole economy, deep decarbonisation. The innovation, the change that's going to have to go through that is going to be completely radical. And I don't think people have really woken up to it yet, especially in industry, in agriculture, in places like housing. So that's going to be a huge driver of change globally, especially on industry. And we saw that, I think, in the other commitments. So we saw issues like country platforms, which we're going to get back to. But we saw a huge amount of initiatives come forward on things like green industrialization, on grids, on batteries, on shared approaches to planning. And I think these are going to be the sinews of how we move forward in the next few years. They're multi, they're country-led, but they're also with business, with policy stakeholders, with finance. And I think those are the motor going forward, yeah, along with the final three kind of oddest things out of this COP, but could be very powerful. One is the transition away from fossil fuel roadmap and the forestry roadmap, which the presidency, the Brazilians will take forward with like-minded partners. Building on the ambiguous success of the finance roadmap, which came out of Azerbaijan, which did some brilliant work and has kind of set us up for the next stage of finance reform, but didn't get as many headlines in Belém as we thought. So in terms of the real economy and the potential for collaboration for change, I think it produced a huge amount below the headlines. Mm. And the question is, how do we capture that going forward?
No, I think, and this roadmap, the Baku to Belém roadmap, we'll come on to that hopefully in a bit more detail. But I thought it was interesting that the Brazilians published that just before, and it felt like they were trying to sort of depoliticize it before getting into the COP. But of course, I mean, Rianne, you as Green Finance Institute, and you know, and thanks, and you also referred to the critical role of finance and business. I was in Sao Paulo, and I was incredibly heartened, I think, to see the sort of continued ambition across all types of financial players and corporates. Tell me about Belém, Rianne, and what you saw and what you think gives us hope for, well, hopefully optimism or maybe realism at the very least.
Firstly, thanks, Emily, for inviting me here today. And thanks to BII, not just for hosting us, but for the work that so many of your colleagues do around the world. It's absolutely valuable in showing us the way. I didn't go to São Paulo. Some of my colleagues did. And that's where business and finance, I think, mostly convened. Because by the time we got to Belém, the topic of business and finance was noticeably absent, actually. And I don't take that as a hugely pessimistic point. It was more business and finance aren't waiting for the politicians to catch up on this agenda. Ultimately, COP was set up as this year to be an implementation COP. But what eventually happened was a political back and forth that ended up in a pretty unambitious agreement. But the good news, Nick, you mentioned things like China. Right? We're waiting for Bloomberg New Energy Finance to come out with their numbers for this year. They track the capital flows every year. So the numbers I'm going to quote from 2024, and I'm sure many of you are familiar with them, right? But $2.1 trillion invested in clean energy technologies in 2024, which is first time it's been more than $2 trillion, is double what was invested in oil and gas exploration. And importantly, a lot's been made of the fact that 40% of that figure was mainland China, $818 billion, as China races forward to become the world's first electric state. So everything you said, Nick. Yeah. There's another way of cutting those numbers, which I think is of interest to us as financiers in the room, which is of that 2.1 trillion, 1.93 trillion was spent on renewables, electrification of transport, grids, and battery storage. Now, what have all those things got in common? They are mature, proven business models in established sectors. So only 154 billion, and that figure down almost 15% year on year, was spent on other areas that are absolutely critical to this transition. Decarbonisation of industry, as you mentioned, electrification of heat, carbon capture storage, carbon dioxide removals, clean fuels for aviation and shipping. And those are the areas where we've still got this green premium, where we've still got technologies that are yet to be proven at scale. We've still got risk-adjusted returns that don't meet the requirements of commercial financial institutions. And this is the area where development banks, government, and the private sector have got their work cut out. And this is the exciting area, right? We know these technologies are going to be critical. And these are the areas where things like country platforms, which seems to be a bit of a catch-all term right now for organizations that are triaging policy, industry, finance, mm-hmm. as well as capturing civil society and academic inputs as well, obviously, because we're trying to do everything from first principles. Those are the convenings that are actually realizing that this is a multi-stakeholder issue, that, you know, commercial banks, there is no ideological opposition from any financier that I've spoken to in the last year, despite the headlines and, you know, walking away from some of the big tent initiatives. No one has any ideological issue in investing in climate technology, climate infrastructure at project level. Mm-hmm. The challenge, I think, is we've gotten ourselves into a little bit of a muddle as a community in speaking about transitions and not speaking clearly when we mean transactions. So governments, the UN, other multilateral organizations are pursuing transitions, transitions of whole economies, global economies, transitions of sectors. Financial institutions are seeking transactions, and we need different strategies for both. And we need to figure out how you ladder one to the other. So one of the very positive things I took from BELM was this: the focus on country platforms, the focus on bringing together the public and private sector to genuinely focus on project level solutions. And if you think about why that is so important for the likes of BII, other development organizations, to development finance organizations, you get a lot of deal flow. You get a lot of people coming to you with transactions that you could be looking to finance. And yet your mission is so much greater than that. It is actually to drive those transitions. So the idea of having a country platform that has endorsed a set of transactions because they are part of a broader political narrative and a political vision enables you to put your money to work in the most catalytic way possible. Mm. And making sure that you've then got the private capital coming alongside you is the way we leverage your balance sheet. And so that was something that I found very positive. A conference that I would have said otherwise was a little bit struggling to find some optimism on some other days.
Yeah. And thanks, Rhiannon. I mean, I was only in Sao Paulo, and actually I came away remarkably optimistic in that.
I wish I'd gone to Sao
Paulo. Yeah, you should have gone. I mean, the Principles for Responsible Investing had their big annual get-together event. There was a Milken Global Investor Symposium, and then also another sustainable investment forum event where there were a lot of asset owners and asset managers. And I mean, the clear takeaway I took from asset owners in particular is climate risk and opportunity is core to fiduciary risk. Mm-hmm. They're not backing down. They know they cannot back down as part of their fiduciary responsibilities. I think one of the challenges, and I kind of felt like almost throwing the gauntlet down to the rest of us, particularly development finance institutions, is how can we bring the pipeline forward so that we can start to get close to the level of ambition that we know is needed. Mm-hmm. Now, Nick, may we come back to you on this Baku to BELM roadmap, which has set a high-level ambition for 1.3 trillion per year of external capital into emerging and developing economies, in addition to, I think, over 1 trillion of domestic capital mobilization per year. How do we get there? And what do you think we should be focused on moving forward as we look ahead?
Well, again, I thought one of the disconnect from BELM to the real world was, I think this year saw some real interesting green shoots of investment starting to flow to new places in sub-Saharan Africa, Pakistan, both for things like solar, batteries, EVs. particularly Africa and Asia. Latin America has always been there. So the, you know, EMDs don't get any money. That narrative seems to be moving as cost ratios move, as some of the impact of the policies and the process that people have been putting in move forward. But we've still got a long way to go. But as you say, there's a lot of money looking for things to do. So for me, we've got to do a few things. The things we can do without having to navigate the difficult geopolitics are look at the money we're putting through DFIs, MDBs, etc., and just make it work harder. Funnily enough, I'm actually bringing a lot of the lessons we work on MDB reform of that work that's been done for the last 4 years and has produced real hundreds of billions of results back into Europe, because Europe's DFIs aren't working hard enough with their capital. Everybody complains about not having money, but they're not looking at how they make it work harder. So I think let's put the accelerator down through individual institutions. But particularly, we know the problem is getting the money down that last kind of piece into policy. And that's where country platforms, 12 country platforms announced in Belém, another 40 we know in preparation. There's probably more in different places. We've got to make that a success. It could be yet another development fad, or it could be a very different way of turning policy commitments into transactions.
Yeah.
So I think and no one's going to stop us doing that. They're just places. And one of the aspirations we have for London Climate Action Week is we land a whole set of large sovereign transactions and commitments like that on country platforms in London next June. Mm-hmm. Because if we can't do that, what is the point of London as a financial centre with a government who's got a whole task force on EMD financing and has made this its number one priority? So I thought that's a thing we can all do. Looking in the medium term, so 3, 4, 5 years, that was 2035 when these targets come through, we do need to change the more fundamental piece of the puzzle. We need the IMF to measure the impact of investment differently when calculating how much headroom you have fiscally. We need to look at risk differently. We need to look potentially at some new ways of putting money through sovereign drawing rights into the banks. That will require winning some votes of the IMF. That will require winning some board battles when the US is hostile. I mean, they're not just neutral. They're hostile. If you read the security strategy, they're very clear. They see the international financial architecture as moving forward their version of energy, not the majority world's version of energy. So that's going to require some clever diplomacy, some new coalitions, and to be honest, support from the financial sector that it's important to measure the risk of climate, it's important to manage transitions properly. Leaning into fossil fuels and all of their risks is not good business, because that is a narrative that is very strong, very well funded, but very wrong. And so there's a kind of those three things for me is how we get those aspirations on the Baku de Belém roadmap and turn them into enough progress that when we get to the next ratchet of the Paris Agreement in 3 years to 5 years, countries go, I can do that. I can turn that technology into development. Because at the moment, one of the things I feel holding people back on their NDCs was a feeling that with the economic headwinds and the uncertainty, they didn't want to push too far. And that's totally understandable when if you're a serious economic policymaker. We've got to change that calculus that it's riskier not to act than it is to hold back. And I think that's our critical challenge for the next 3 years.
Yeah. No, really, really interesting points there. And coming back to you, Rianne, and you mentioned previously this focus on transactions, how critical that is, and transition, particularly going beyond the energy and e-mobility sectors. And I think at BI, we were delighted. It was actually announced at the G20. We had our first transition finance transaction with First Rand Bank in South Africa. And that's actually working to help deploy their capital to decarbonize hard to abate sectors across Africa.
Congratulations.
So we're really excited about that. But I think, you know, I would love to hear a bit more what you think is needed to really scale and or replicate these transactions where we at the pace that we need to see that.
I'm very passionate about this. Is there any possibility of putting up the slide that I forwarded, please? Thank you. I hope we can make that out. So this is what I took to Belém with me, and it exactly answers your question, Amal, which is how do we try and bridge that gap between financial government setting ambitious long-term targets for what they want to do with their economies. And as you say, cat's out the bag on that one. We don't, realistically, nobody's going to start, you know, thinking that they can go backwards and, you know, bank on becoming a petro state. I mean, regardless of what some people might be saying. We'll move on. That's a whole different set of remarks. But anyway, so, you know, you start with establishing a national goal. That then needs to get translated into policy and regulation, move through to, you know, creating the right incentives to create both supply and demand, making sure that you've got the right market infrastructure, building the right institutions. So all the work you've been doing on MDBs, I know you've done a lot of work on green banks as well, Nick, over the years. But, you know, if we're going to say we're going to deploy government money, what are the actual vehicles that are going to deploy that capital? How are they going to get it into the hands of developers, or, you know, actually use it in blended finance structures with the commercial counterparties? And I won't go through, you basically, it goes through this loop until you get to turning domestic, you turn a domestic asset class into an international asset class, right? And this looks familiar, this kind of value chain, to anybody that has worked in financial services. It's how we do deals. You start off with an objective, your client asks you to do something, you're very clear on what it is you need to do. To be fair, everyone's very incentivized to get it done. And then you align all the different people who've got different skills, recognizing that one person can't do every job in that value chain, but someone coordinates the whole thing so that at the end, you've got a term sheet, you've got a deal, and you can actually put money to work. This has been missing from the climate finance approach that we've been taking as a community for a long time. And I'll just give a quick example. We were invited in by one of the governments that's doing some fantastic work in an emerging market. Said, we want you to look at how we attract more commercial capital working with our development bank to industrial decarbonisation. It was like fantastic, it's perfect GFI type transaction. We were excited about it. Set up a team in the capital, got going. I rang a few people I know who were doing policy work in that country and asked, what are you doing? You know, could we help work with you? And they said, oh yeah, the government's brought us in. We're doing loads of great work on deforestation. Oh, okay, that's not going to help so much. And then I was like, okay, let's bring somebody else who's doing some really good work with corporates in that country. I said, could we work with you? And they said, oh yeah, we've been brought in by the government to look at what policies do corporates need in order to do the transition. I'm like, oh great, well, how are you going to finance that? Can we dock in? And it turns out there was no overlap at all in the areas of interest. So we're pulling huge deal teams together, all of whom are working on different deals. No alignment on what we're actually trying to do. Imagine how powerful it would be if we went into some of these regions or countries and said, right then, let's do the techno-economic modeling at a macro level. How much capital do you need to build a charging infrastructure to actually move to 95% renewables, to actually, you know, move towards regenerative agriculture? And then we'll work back, get the experts that you need at every stage of that deal team. And we will all work for the next few years on getting the money that you need to actually deploy in what it is you're trying to do. And the thing that's different in that little chain that we've built, and because it's part of a longer paper called Transactions to Transitions, is at every step you co-design for banking and fundability. Mm-hmm. That's the bit that I think years ago that used to happen, and then it sort of fell out of favor. Mm-hmm. But it's like, if you're working on enabling policy, is that enabling policy with a view to bringing in capital? Because if it isn't, I'm afraid a plan that doesn't specify how it will get financed is actually just an idea. Mm-hmm. And we spent a fair bit of time looking at some of the country platform deal pipelines that were put forward at BELM. And it was a bit distressing because big numbers were being bandied around saying, you know, we're attracting 20 billion and blah, blah, blah. And so we sat down with the developers, sort of things you guys do every day, and just sort of said, okay, let's figure out how close are you to final investment decision. And that 20 billion quickly whittled down to 50 million. Wow. The rest were concepts, really important concepts that with some project preparation, some of the technical assistance you guys provide and others could one day be projects. But right now they're not projects, and let's not mix up the two.
Yeah. Well, I'm conscious we don't have much more time, but maybe Nick, just turn to you for the last sort of 2 minutes. You mentioned London Climate Action Week. I know we at BI were delighted to be a key partner for LCOR. And you mentioned also this focus on country platforms. How can these country platforms actually help facilitate what Rhian is talking about here? What is needed? What's the missing ingredient or ingredients, if you like? Just a few ideas.
So in some ways people say country platforms are as old as time. I mean, if you have, you know, post-war reconstruction, but they have to be done properly. So what we'd like to see at London Climate Action Week, and so working with partners like BII, is let's be honest with ourselves. That's what Rhiannon said. Let's create a space where we talk honestly about the kind of vaporware bits and how do we make it work. Mm-hmm. And I think it's not just me, London, we're working with Dublin, New York, Singapore, hopefully Tokyo, Shanghai Climate Weeks, all of which are finance themed, to make this something we Mumbai, do all of next year. Mumbai,
really?
Interestingly, because rather than having the same conversation every year, why don't we take a conversation on what's a good country platform through those weeks with those different finance centres, a bit of healthy competition, but also a much more rigorous approach to testing what's working. So I think that for me is the kind of one of the exciting things we're looking at this year. And to be honest, the enthusiasm is huge. You say Mumbai's moving in, we've got Prague Climate Action Week coming in. I was in Dublin last week. We are not lacking energy, but focus and honesty is where we're at. Mm-hmm. That's for the scale up. And then the other ones which are interesting, both for London and elsewhere, is we're going to have a huge focus on nature finance, a huge focus on resilience finance, and hopefully we've got a big buildings conference coming in, a big industry conference coming in, hopefully. So we're starting to create communities around some of the so-called hard to abate, sometimes easier than you think to abate, but quite fragmented centres. Mm. So again, it's for me, it's all about organisation, all about getting ourselves to be honest and driving through the year. So COP is where you land things, not where you do things. We do things in a few places through the year, which we organise, and then we land in COP and say, look, it's possible, do more.
Thank you. And
the final word very quickly. Okay. I just think Nick doesn't take enough credit for being the architect of London Climate Action Week. So congratulations to you. I think it's fantastic. And it's genuinely putting London on the map as an opportunity to demonstrate how we can be focused and do this well.
That's all we have time for in this episode. For more detail, do check out the investor panel on mobilising capital for impact. The link is in the notes. Thanks for listening to this Impact Equals podcast. We'll see you again soon.